Hello, my name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm a GP and the Essential Knowledge Updates clinical lead. And today in this podcast, I'm speaking to Dr. David Stevens. He's a GP in Scotland and also one of the clinical leads for osteoporosis for a number of different guidelines. He also is an advisor on osteoporosis and on the RCGP Scottish and UK Council.
But importantly, a practicing GP and will help me navigate this complicated world of osteoporosis, hopefully in our discussion today. Hi, David. Nice to speak to you today. And on an area of osteoporosis, which I think you've had a little bit of interest over the years, is that right?
Probably now for about 10 years. It was something I thought I didn't know a lot about. So I put myself forward to do the NICE guidelines. And actually, I've learned an enormous amount since then and been on the SIGN guidelines and continued to follow the developments in osteoporosis over the last 10 years.
So I thought today we could really reflect on what osteoporosis is, maybe some of the challenges that we as GPs face. And the recent EKU was focusing on the SIGN guidelines, which made some changes in recommendations. But it's great to have you on board, continue input in a few different guidelines and really thinking about how we might help GPs navigate these guidelines and implement them into their practice.
I think navigate's the right word, because different guidelines sometimes give you different information. And what you do when you're getting conflicting information and you're a GP, you're on the ground, you've got to apply your patient's condition to guidelines which are not quite so patient friendly.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to go back, how would you define osteoporosis? What's your definition that you might use?
There's a World Health Organization definition, and I'll try and put this in normal language. They say it's progressive skeletal disease, which is characterized by low bone mass and microarchitectural deterioration in the bone tissue, with consequent increase in bone fragility and susceptibility to fracture. Basically, your bones become thin as usually you get older, and you are more susceptible to something called a fragility fracture, which is a fracture which wouldn't normally occur if you had that trauma.
And I guess it's important to diagnose and treat because of reducing that risk in fragility fractures, which can be quite devastating.
Well, when you think that for a hip fragility fracture, the mortality is 20% in a year, it becomes a really serious condition. So, yes, it's important to diagnose. And nowadays, there is considerable treatment which will decrease the chances of a further fracture. When I first was in practice, the only treatment available, which I was advised by a consultant for someone with quite severe osteoporosis, was oily fish. So we've moved on a bit in the last 30 years, and we have quite a lot of very effective anti-osteoporosis treatments.
And I guess primary care GPs have a key role here, but there are challenges.
Well, I think the challenge is that the presentation is quite often in secondary care with someone presenting with a fracture. And then the immediate concern is how to treat that fracture. And beyond that, which is just as important, is how to ensure that this is followed up. And here we come to the divide between primary and secondary care, or between secondary care and primary care, which is nowadays being covered quite effectively by fracture liaison services. And one of the roles I've had is advising fracture liaison services in England how to make sure we maximise the treatment of osteoporosis diagnosed after someone has had a fragility fracture. Fracture liaison services tend to be able to reach 50% of people who've had a fracture, and they need to make sure that of those people, at least 80% are put on treatment. So how to do that within the NHS is really a test of our organisation. And from a GP's point of view, how to make sure if one of your patients have a fragility fracture, they are diagnosed and treated for osteoporosis over a long period of time.
So that's certainly one route coming in. You might be, as an example, GP looking at your documentation coming in and you get a coded fragility fracture. One of your team has coded that in the notes. So I think it's then important maybe that triggers a quality indicator to review about treatment recommendations there and then and think about treatment going forward.
Yes, and over the last few years, it's become more important because we've been able to identify what we call patients at imminent risk of a further fracture. So these are patients who have very low bone density and do benefit from treatment with a developing class of anti-osteoporosis treatment. These are the anabolic drugs, which are different from the anti-resorptive drugs, which we usually use. So the anti-resorptive drugs are drugs like alendronate, which most GPs are familiar with. once weekly at 70 milligrams usually, or resendrolate. But the new drugs which are being used, unfortunately, are given intravenously, and these are drugs like teriparatide and romosozumab, which is a new one of the MAB drugs. Now, these are really much more effective at preventing further fractures and actually are starting to go towards the vision which the Royal Osteoporosis Society have of preventing osteoporosis.
So if someone's had a fragility fracture, we get that sort of activation. You'd hope if they had an admission, they'd have a follow-up treatment implemented. I guess that's a sort of quality measure as well to sort of look at. And then maybe to think about primary prevention. Now, like a lot of GPs, I mean, I work in the city of London, I have a relatively young population, multi-ethnic, so osteoporosis isn't really on the front of my mind. And I don't really get patients coming in saying, doctor, I want to get checked for osteoporosis. So how do we really sort of keep thinking about maybe when to risk assess someone and the risk factors and primary prevention for osteoporosis?
Screening for osteoporosis has not been shown to be effective. So GPs need to just keep an eye out for someone that they think might need an assessment with a bone density scan. So those sort of people would be people they might see with a kyphosis when they come in, people who have lost height. They need to think about postmenopausal women in particular, because they are much more at risk. And then they need to think of the group of patients who have illnesses which cause malabsorption and prevent them getting the calcium and vitamin D which they require. They also need to think about their patients who are on particular drugs which cause osteoporosis, and the main one of which GPs have many are patients who are on steroids. So particularly high dose steroids cause you to lose bone density. But there are also a couple of other drugs which the GP needs to be aware of. And those are drugs which, like the aromatase inhibitors, which women who have had breast cancer are usually on, or the men with androgen deprivation, usually if they're treated for prostate cancer. So these in general are people who are elderly, so they don't really fit a young population. But actually, GPs need to be keeping an eye out for all these groups of patients and considering whether they should have a bone density scan, which brings us on to the assessment of whether you should have a bone density scan.
Yeah, so as we've said, we've maybe had a patient that we've thought about maybe doing a risk assessment. What would the next steps be? So you said maybe thinking about a bone density scan. Would you utilise any tools in primary care to help make that decision?
Well, here we have the computer, which is a great boon for this. And there are a couple of tools. One's called FRAX, which you're probably familiar with, and the other's called QFracture. And you input the risk factors into those computer programs, which are available either on the internet or embedded in your software. And that will give you the chances of an individual patient having a fragility fracture over the next 10 years. So with that, using either the 10% chance in 10 years, which the sign guidance uses, or the specific risk factors which FRAX uses, you can make a decision as to whether a DEXA scan is indicated. The DEXA scan is the definitive way of diagnosing osteoporosis.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember getting a few of them come through, and thankfully they have some nice have a little guidance on them, because they're normally done the DEXAs at the hip and the spine, from what I recall, and it just gives you the sort of T score, and it's minus 2.5 or more negative if that's correct for osteoporosis.
Yeah. With a bit of luck, the fracture liaison service will recommend who should be treated and how they should be treated. But this is changing as well with the new anabolic medications.
And we had a look at SINE recently in the UKU, which came down more towards Q fracture. And obviously Q fracture is from the same team that developed Q risk, which a lot of us will be aware of, which are risk assessment tools, and it's embedded within the electronic health record. As I say, they recommended that, while the previous NICE guidelines said choose either that or a Q fracture or FRAX. So how do we sort of navigate the guideline differences as a GP?
Well, I think in general, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. One of the reasons that Q fracture was chosen by SINE was that FRAX wasn't completely in the public domain, but FRAX has got lots of other advantages over Q fracture, and particularly in this new group of people who are at imminent risk of fracture. FRAX has been able to develop a way of identifying this group of people who should have treatment with anabolic medications rather than anti-resorptive medication. And these are people who need urgent treatment within a few weeks or a few months to make sure that they don't refracture, or to reduce the risk of them refracturing.
You mentioned the fracture liaison service. Is that led by rheumatology colleague normally, or?
It can be led by different groups of people in different areas, but in general, it's bone specialists who are the leaders here. And usually it's facilitated by a fracture liaison nurse who picks up all the patients with fractures and makes sure that they get a DEXA scan and make sure that they are recommended for treatment.
And then going back to that primary prevention patient, so we've done the risk assessment, which, you know, we've kind of navigated either use Frax or use Q-fracture. As you said, the Q-fracture, is, as I understand, is 10% or greater risk over 10 years to recommend to go to your DEXA scan. Get the DEXA scan back, which does show osteoporosis. So then a treatment discussion would you have with the patient?
Well, I think, you know, you need to be patient-centered in this and discuss not only the treatment, but the potential side effects. And although on balance, if you've got osteoporosis, you are better off being treated, there are occasionally some quite serious side effects from osteoporosis treatment. So at the moment, if you're not at imminent risk, you should think about either having alendronate or you should have intravenous zoledronic acid. Now, that potentially creates an issue, and particularly if you've had a hip fracture, IV zoledronic acid is a much more effective treatment. But that requires having IV infusion, and that isn't always easily available within general practice. So some liaison with secondary care would be quite useful. If it requires a referral, that might take quite a long time. If it requires a discussion and the possibility of going to the day hospital, that might be more easy to facilitate. But we are developing, particularly in Nottingham, Apinda Sahata has developed a primary care intravenous treatment arrangement supported by him in secondary care. So there are some quite good developments in how to access this.
And I think, obviously, I want to repeat prescribing, so I've got a care home that I look after. So we do have a few patients on alendronate, alendronic acid. And obviously, when you prescribe it initially, it does say about the sitting up. And as I understand, it's 30 minutes before breakfast of instructions.
Yes, it is quite complicated to make sure that you stand up or after you've had your alendronate or your resedronate. Moving on, there is another drug called denosumab, which GPs might have been asked to prescribe. That's becoming less popular because what we found is that on stopping denosumab, there is an increased fracture risk. And so you have to have a plan to continue with a anti-resorptive drug after you've had an oral anti-resorptive drug. Mm-hmm. After you've stopped denosumab. The treatment for imminent risk, when that's defined, would require anabolic drugs, and those again need to be given intravenously. So a way of identifying those, if you're the GP, and referring for that or making an arrangement to have it, and usually it has to be in secondary care, is a way of preventing your patients having a further fracture.
Obviously, most commonly, we'd be utilising the bisphosphonates in primary care. People will be aware of those and would have prescribed those. Maybe touch on some of the risks. So I understand that can cause problems with the jaw, and maybe it can cause gastritis or even the slight signal of a risk with stomach and esophageal gastric cancers, if that's correct.
Yes, I'm not quite sure about the gastric cancers, but it certainly can cause esophagitis. The osteonecrosis of the jaw is a particularly nasty side effect. I must say it is very rare, and it's very important that good dental care is started right at the beginning. And if patients have got dental problems, those need to be looked at promptly by the dentist before you start treatment.
In terms of the guidelines, you've started a patient on treatment. When would you recommend reviewing that medication or redoing a DEXA scan?
Well, I don't think you need to do the DEXA scan probably for at least 3 years. The review of treatment should be probably about 15 weeks, and that's to see whether there's compliance with the medication. Compliance is an enormous problem with the treatment for osteoporosis. And one of the things about giving intravenous treatment is obviously that makes the compliance considerably less of a problem. You're probably giving the IV treatment every 6 months or even longer. And that means that although there may be a compliance problem, it means that patients have their treatment and then they can go away and forget about it for a while.
And in terms of bisphosphonate length of treatment, I understand maybe recommended a maximum 5 to 10 years. Is that right?
I think the interesting thing is there isn't a lot of evidence about how long you should have treatment, because it takes a very long time to work out whether a treatment should be continued. But the recommendation is that it should be reviewed. And if the bone density has improved, it may be that it's appropriate to stop the treatment. But when it comes to the anti-resorptives, in general, this is a lifelong treatment. I think that needs to be a discussion with the patient, patient-centered discussion, saying, well, we don't know how long this treatment should be, but you haven't had a fracture or you have had a fracture, and I, as your GP, would recommend that you carry on with this treatment. There is also a bit of an issue about what do we do when patients become frail and have multimorbidity. There's certainly been a move in the RCGP about overdiagnosis and having people on treatments when actually over the next 5 years, they may not benefit from them. Certainly, there is an area where people are having palliative care, and it's quite clear that taking these drugs is not going to improve their life over the period when they're taking it. So GPs need to be aware that stopping these drugs in some circumstances is the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about, we've covered previously the multimorbidity guidelines. I mean, there's a lack of evidence around multimorbidity in older populations, but certainly bisphosphonates came up as one to review, along with statins in your sort of nursing home or frail populations, thinking about maybe what's the predicted life expectancy? Is it a year or so, or maybe less? And then to think about medical optimization using tools like stop-start, and I think there's some other tools as well. And I guess maybe, say, with primary care networks and other evolving primary care staff, including pharmacists, maybe taking on some of these roles for medication reviews and management.
Putting the other point of view, I did mention a very famous person who had a hip fracture at 101, and we do have an increasingly elderly population, and preventing a hip fracture in someone who's 101 may be a really important thing to be doing. I don't think you should be too cavalier about stopping bone anti-resorptive drugs. It just has to be a balance, which is all about being a GP.
And individualise to the patient you're seeing.
Yes.
And yeah, but I mean, we touched a little bit about sort of fracture days on secondary care. So thinking back maybe then to our primary care prevention patient, we started bisphosphonate, maybe the treatment failure. I guess then, as you said, you might refer to consideration of IV treatment. Or is there any other sort of treatments maybe that, or when you'd refer to secondary care for advice?
One needs to think about vertebral fractures, which aren't so obviously diagnosed in some situations. Quite often they're picked up opportunistically on MRI scans, but they do cause enormous morbidity and probably mortality. I don't know if you in your have experienced an elderly person who's suddenly got very severe back pain and can't get out of bed. So they can cause enormous disability. So maybe those need to be referred. If the bone density is particularly low, one of the guidelines says below 3.5, then that might be a reason to refer. If people have got multiple risk factors, that might be a good reason to refer. And risk factors are previous fractures, alcohol, liver disease, chronic renal failure. These patients will probably need specialist input. And thinking about patients who are on high-dose steroids, their bones deteriorate very quickly, so they may be good candidates for having anabolic treatment.
And I get we touched on risk factors and lifestyle a little bit, but of course, key role of primary care is addressing lifestyle factors, irrespective of medication recommendations.
Well, certainly lifestyle has some evidence that it does prevent the deterioration or prevent osteoporosis, and exercise, particularly on weight-bearing exercise, so dancing, Zumba, and I suppose as opposed to swimming, which, you know, is very good exercise, but it doesn't particularly help your osteoporosis. Walking, running, although that's sometimes not great for your knees, but things which transmit a pressure through your spine and through your legs increases your bone density.
I guess then, summarising, obviously you've been on a few different guidelines. What is the recommended navigation for GPs, or any sort of top tips that you have?
I think the first thing is to put your patient first and have a discussion with them about the various treatments. And, you know, that's quite difficult because sometimes you get a referral from secondary care that someone's had a fracture. And I think a patient who's had a fracture and is going to go on treatment really should have a consultation. With COVID, it's very difficult to have a face-to-face consultation, but ideally a face-to-face consultation and discussing what the options are over this quite a long period of preventing any further fractures. I think you need to keep your eye on the changes which there are going on with osteoporosis and possibly think about whether intravenous treatment for your patient would be the best option, particularly where there are issues of maintaining the medication over a period of time. And I think probably on the other hand, thinking whether you're over-treating people, you're giving them medications which might cause them harm, is a really important part of being a GP.
Thanks, David. We talked a little bit about lifestyle. Some people question also about calcium and vitamin D treatment, if that's necessary.
Ideally, people need to have sufficient vitamin D and sufficient calcium in their diet. And without that, they're at risk of osteopenia. There is one little caveat, which is that occasionally if people have high calcium and hyperparathyroidism, giving them calcium as a blanket treatment for perhaps all the elderly in a nursing home is not in their interest. So probably measuring their calcium before they have calcium and vitamin D may be quite sensible.
Yeah, and certainly I work in an area where 50% of people are vitamin D deficient. That's in East London. So we do recommend, or, you know, we try to, in a way, non-medicalize vitamin D and actually recommend everyone takes the supplement, certainly from October to April, where actually even if we did get adequate outdoor exposure, we wouldn't make any vitamin D. So I think it is a really big, important issue, maybe also for public health as well.
Yes, and, you know, that's particularly true in Scotland, where we don't have so much sunlight as you do in London.
I guess the important thing from our discussion today is really thinking about osteoporosis, having it at the back of your mind, even if, like me, you have a young population, really to think about which patients could be at risk of it. And that brings the importance of primary care and the continuity of care about actually flagging up patients on, as you said, the risk factors of age, postmenopausal women, steroids, etc. And thinking about when to risk assess using either FRAX or Q fracture and referring for a DEXA scan.
Thinking about young populations, there are two groups which I think are important. One is people with HIV, which, you know, not terribly obvious in the population, but is important to be aware of. And the other is I've had a family with osteoporosis, and they were young men who had fractures playing rugby, which you wouldn't expect. Well, you might expect, but they seem to be too many. And I did find that actually, when I went through the family history, all the brothers had had fractures playing rugby. So young populations do get osteoporosis.
And so the importance there of family history and doing your assessment of that patient in front of you, like you say. David, thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting discussion. If we can fly the flag for osteoporosis, yes, it's a complicated area, and I have to keep always looking up the guidelines or CKS or using sort of different tools. And I guess, do you have any top tips? How do you remember some of these guideline recommendations?
I think CKS is one of the best ways of doing it. And I am constantly, particularly being on signed counsel, trying to develop better ways so that during a 10-minute consultation, a GP can look up things which they want to know easily. I think reading through the guidelines in part of your CPD, I suppose, is part of that. But sometimes these guidelines are pretty impenetrable and are not written with the view that you're seeing the patient. It's that they're written and then you've got to fit your patient to the guidelines. We need to develop better ways of doing that.
Thank you so much, David, for your time. Really appreciate it. You were listening to Essential Knowledge Updates podcast from the RCGP. And my name is Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you for listening today.